Well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage. And today is the 12th of July, 2012. And we're talking with Don Williamson down in Greensville, Tennessee. So, Don, you've had a very successful and lengthy kind of a career. We're anxious to hear more about it. So, why don't you tell us where you're brought up?
Well, I was brought up here in Greene County, or Greenville, Tennessee, and of course was a farm boy. But in my early days, I was very active in sports and music. But when I went on to school here and went to East Tennessee State University and graduated and became a teacher in my early 20s. And then after that, in my 20s, after I was a teacher and a coach for about 5 years, I got a job in the local. I was hired as the local recreation director for the city of Greenville. And that's where I first started my dance future. I inherited a ballroom dance class from the recreation director at the time, was Lewis Calhoun, who was also a caller, and I followed him into calling in a sense. And I succeeded him, and after I took over, then he left, and I took over his program. I took over the ballroom dance class, and then we had one dancer, one couple from the West that had a little bit of experience in Western style square dancing, and they said, let's have a square dance. So we had a square dance, and we got introduced to the Western square dancing, which was just catching on during the 50s there and becoming popular, and we got very interested, and that's where I got started. And that class became square dance class, and we moved on from there. Now this is over 50 years later, and I'm still at it.
There you go. Backing up a little bit, somewhere along the line there, you were involved in professional baseball?
Yes. When I was born, my daddy, I think, anticipated he was a kind of a semi-pro country ball player, and he was sort of interested in baseball. And my mother, of course, was a musician. I've sort of been a little bit of a confused musician and athlete all my life, and ended up a square dance caller. But as far as baseball, I was I guess I was 18, and I was signed to a professional group. The New York Giants organization sent me to Florida and started. So I played 2 years of professional baseball, and then they were going to send me out to California or somewhere, and I had an opportunity to play some independent ball with some other people, and I got involved with that. And after that, I played. Right much up until I was 35 years old, and then I hurt my leg and got out of it. But I've really been interested in baseball and other sports all my life. But so I'm kind of a confused musician and baseball player, I guess, at the same time.
Right. What position do you play?
I was a middle infielder, a shortstop, and I guess the highest part of my career, I was playing in a national tournament out in Wichita, Kansas. They have a national tournament of semi-professional baseball players, and a lot of the old big league players and the college stars and different ones play with the different states. Right. And a lot of the military the players from the professional ranks that were there, they go out there, and they're still having that tournament.
Right.
And I was selected 1 year playing with the local Magnavox team here, as I think it's 1956. I was selected All-American shortstop. And
there you go.
Alongside three or four of the big league players. So that was sort of the high point of my baseball career.
Yes, it sure was, right. Well, then a little bit later, I understand you did some work in the mental handicap.
Yes, from the city recreation job that I mentioned earlier, I had a little, I was thinking about going into business with another person. That didn't turn out too well, so I moved from that position and accepted a position as director of adjunctive therapy, which was a department head with it's mental health and retardation for the state of Tennessee.
Right.
So I got involved with that, and even, of course, did some square dancing with those people and so on. But I stayed there 24 years, and with my teaching background, I did retire in my 50s there from that position.
Well, that's great. Well, getting back to square dancing now, you were talking about Louis Calhoun. Remember that name? And so do you consider him one of your mentors?
Yes, this was quite a personality. He had a lot to do with the development of square dance in the Carolinas. He left the position here and went to Winston-Salem to take a position in the Recreation and Parks Department over there, and he was really got into square dancing in a big way and did a whole lot for square dancing in North Carolina. And then he was hired down at Fontana Village. You may have heard of Fontana.
Yes.
It was one of the leading places for the people from the southeast and the north that used to come in here. And that's really where I first got indoctrinated into large groups, and they used to have live band. And we'd go over there every spring and fall, and it was just people from all over the eastern states would come. We'd have 35, 40 squares, and it was just tremendous. So Lewis was a director there for a while, and he went on to have quite a career in calling until he got killed in a car wreck. I think he was still in his 50s. But I succeeded him, and, yeah, he would be one of my early mentors.
Yeah. Who were some of the other callers at Fontana?
Well, I remember A.B. Coleman was a local caller from this area. And then there was a caller over there, Jay Orr. And then, of course, later on, Tex Brownlee. You remember Tex?
Sure, I remember Tex.
He took over from Calhoun, and he ran the program there at Fontana for several years. And, the different callers came in from the different states, and each week had a different caller. There were just a lot of them, and I was one of many that was in, I don't...
Great. And so I understand you were also involved with caller schools, and you did some...
Yeah, I did. I got involved with Cal Golden, which I'm sure you know Cal. And
I do.
We did some, of course, we have did the Red Boot recording, so we'll probably talk about in a minute. But I got involved with Cal. He invited me to come and help him with some of his caller schools, and I got involved, and I guess that's where I first got interested. And then when Caller Lab first started that caller coach program with Bob Antwerp and Cal and Bob, I think Al Brundage, your brother there, was in on that.
Yes, he was, yeah.
And the different ones, and I took the test and with Al and with John Jones and passed those tests, and then I got involved, and then I got to doing several by myself, and I had right much luck. I sort of enjoyed that. For several years there, I had quite a few caller schools.
Right. Yes, so did. Have you got any well-known callers that graduated from your school?
Any well-known callers? Several area callers here. I don't know that any that would be known too much on the Nashville level. I know over in Carolina, which I did not call an awful lot in the Carolinas, we had a caller by the name of Richard Silver, who is still alive, but he's having some physical problems now. And right now, Jerry Biggerstaff is calling. You may have heard Jerry's
name. Yes, I've heard that.
I started Jerry.
Yeah.
And,
well, along with your career, you must have attended a lot of festivals and...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, we started with, I think maybe the first national I did was, up in Louisville, they've had two or three since then, but way back there, that was my first one, and then I attended... Oh, many years at the national conventions, and then we did all of Caller Lab for about 20-some years there, and then I missed a few due to some physical problems. But other festivals and weekend dances and things like that, I haven't called in all the states, but most of them.
Well, that's...
And we've been into all of those festivals and things,
yeah.
Guest callers, and I guess too many to mention. And, of course, when we got the Red Boot Boys going, that's a quartet of boys we had. I don't know if you know that, I guess.
Yes, I was going to ask you about them.
Yeah, we did an awful lot of festivals and weekends and things for about a 20-year period there.
Yeah. That's great. That sounds like I never heard of any other group like that. And, might you tell us a little bit about, you know, where you appeared and what your act was?
Oh, well, the Red Boot Boys got started. They were all recording with my record label, which is Red Boot Records, and we were doing a festival in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, with kind of a callers, federation type festival, and we had a large crowd. And someone just said, "You guys get up here and practice together, and we'll all call together." So we practiced a few songs, and most of us kind of had a southern background in gospel music and stuff like that, and we got together and sounded pretty good, and we performed that night, and all they liked it, and that just got started, so we just made a thing out of it. And I guess the biggest boost we got was when Caller Lab was in Chicago, and we did a performance at Chicago, and that got us kind of known all over, so we were booked solid for a long time there. Our program was to, we called the dance, and each caller would do the patter part, and then we'd, in four-part harmony, we'd do the singing call. And that was primarily the pattern, and at the end of the dance, we would do a 30 or 40 minute concert of just regular music.
Yeah.
And different barbershop and country and western and the old favorites and stuff like that. And went over pretty good, and we enjoyed it, but there was a lot of traveling. We did quite a few. I can recall a couple of the biggest ones, I guess, was down there in Houston, Texas. You know, the big one they had at Pasadena. We did that 2 years, I think, and we must have had 100-some squares there. That was quite a time down there.
Right. You were talking about different experiences. Had you ever been out of the country calling?
Yeah, I've been overseas twice. The first time, Al Stevens married a German girl, and he over there, and he and I got together, and we did a caller seminar over there in Frankfurt, Germany. And I flew over for that, and we did a seminar up there in the mountains, and we had quite a few of the young German callers, and boy, those fellows were sharp as a tack.
Uh-huh.
And Kenny Reese was originally a Texas caller, and I believe I saw where he passed away recently. But Kenny was our host there, and he had said, but I did that one, and then later on, Davis, I forget his first name, Davis, he's passed away too. He had us over to do it in England.
Oh, yes.
So we did a festival weekend with him over there. So I had two trips across there, and then across the Pacific, I've been to Hawaii. That's still in the U.S., I guess.
Yes, right.
But I never did get on over to Japan. I started a time or two. And,
yeah. Well.
But I enjoyed the times over there, and we had some interesting experiences over there.
I'm sure. Right. Well, along the way, somewhere along the line, I understand that you were the one that came off the slaughter wheel.
Oh, my. Yes. I was calling over in Carolina, which I used to, goodness knows, I used to call all over Carolina throughout the week and then come back and go to work the next day. But I was driving through the mountain, and must have been in the early 70s, and I was thinking it was the time when Fan the Top had come out, and the dancers were having a little trouble getting the girls to use that left hand or something there. And I was just thinking along those lines, driving along, and I said, well, what would happen if we let them use their right hand and just do it? So I sort of wrote that on the road, and I got there, and I walked them through the flutter wheel, and they kind of liked it, and we adjusted a little bit. And this lady says, oh, that's it's a dentist's wife that used to travel with us. She said, that's a flutter wheel. I didn't even know what a flutter wheel was. It's some kind of a little where you put in the creek or in the stream, and a little toy thing they call it a flutter wheel. That's where she got the name, so she actually named it.
I'll be darned.
And then when I brought it out, Flippo and some of them got a hold of it, and I think that's what made it popular. They started using it. But Willard Ehrlich is actually the one that I was trying to call the reverse flutter wheel. I was trying to call it a left.
Oh, I see.
Willard Ehrlich suggested I call it reverse flutter wheel, so I did that. And that's sort of the history behind that.
Well, that's interesting. Well, speaking of Willard Ehrlich, I just interviewed Ron Schneider. Do you remember him?
Oh, yeah, Ron. Well, he and I and Mike Hoos still are calling Knoxville. We sort of staff callers down there. So
yes.
I see him once in a while. But
yeah.
He's a good one. We used to work festivals over at Myrtle Beach. And he was, and I were on the same staff over there. We had some good ones. Ron was a terrific caller.
Yeah. And who are some of the other callers that you have worked with?
Well, I've worked with most of them at one time or another, but some of the early callers that we had, I remember, of course, Elmer Sheffield was one of them that kind of got started with our record company, and Bob Vineyard, the late Bob Vineyard out of St. Louis, was a good one. And one of our early recording callers was Lee Kopman. He, you know, Lee wanted to always do some singing calls.
Right.
And he did a few recordings with us. And I worked with some of the, I remember Dick Jones, and then...
How about Ed Gilmore?
Well, I never did. I danced to Ed, and some of his music I just really liked. It's that smooth music.
Yes.
But I never did. He was a little before my time. He used to come through here on his travels, and we'd go dance to him, and I really enjoyed him, but I didn't get never get to work with him.
Yeah. How about Les Gotcher?
Now, Les was, along with Flippo, and kind of where I learned to start calling. Of course, back then, Les had put out some little patter records. And, of course, Flippo had some of his albums and so on, and that's kind of the way we learned to phrase and so on. Some of my phrasing is still like old Les.
Uh-huh.
He was, as far as choreography, he was one of our heroes. We had him through here calling for us for a club when I was just starting. But I never did work with him, but we hired him to call for us.
Yes.
A few times. And he was something else.
Yes, he was. So, well, shall we get talking about Red Boot?
Oh, I guess that's a good subject.
Okay.
Well, while I was at the developmental center, I was just sitting in there. We saw how effective these singing calls were, and enjoying music myself, that was one of the big things, and I think now we're kind of neglecting the musical side of the activity. I think it's one of our problems. But
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
We said, I think I'll just see about making one of these greatest records. So I booked a studio in Nashville and went down there and had no idea what I was going to do. And we picked up and started and did White Christmas and a little patter record. I think I did a beginning class or something. That I don't know whatever happened to that, but sort of got it started. And then we had a few hits there. And, of course, as you know, we all started with the old 78 records. But
sure.
After the 45s came in there, then that's really when I got to going. And we booked the studio there in Nashville, and then later on we got to recording in local studios and in Knoxville, and then it just got to be a thing. We just that's long about the time Elmer came along, and then we had a few that got popular on the national scene, and we just kept doing it. And my son is a big part of it. He started out playing with the band in the studio when he was about 14 years old. He'd play a little organ, and he could play rhythm guitar and so on. And as the years went along, he started, we'd have to holler after the musicians left. We'd holler for him to come in there and fix something. So he's still in his 50s, and he's a professional musician now. And he's played with a lot of the guys, Lee Greenwood and Louise Mandrell and people at that level.
Yeah.
But he's a...
Did you say he
has his own studio, and he's a music minister, and he's still into that. But... And also, this is interesting. This is the second year at the state convention, which comes up here in August. He's getting a band together, and they've hired him to play live music at the state convention.
I see.
So that's quite a display, and it's just it was real successful last year. I don't know how it's going to go each year, but.
Well, that's great. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, many people in the modern generation don't know what vinyl was. And, of course, the early records were 78 RPM, and then they had 33 and a third, and then they had the studio records that were even slower than that. But I was interested in what was a ball... Tell us about the transition from vinyl to the more modern ones, like CDs.
Well, yes, I don't know how that happened. The 45 records, the low ones, is the ones that for many years there that we were all using, and quite a few of the callers still use them. And incidentally, some of the local newspapers are coming out there as some kind of a revival of the vinyl recordings taking place. The stores are reopening and so on. So we may see a slight revival in that. But what happened there, the digital abilities came along and people could transfer it to the music to the CDs. And then later on, most of us now are using a laptop computer.
Sure.
I do. I have all my music on a laptop computer, and I can speed it up, slow it down,
yeah,
raise the pitch up, or lower it, which I have to do with my voice problems, and sometimes, depending on the situation, I that's real helpful.
Yeah.
And of course, used to, if a record was too low or too high or something, why, we couldn't do that.
Yes.
So that's kind of replaced the records now, and that's the way most callers, I think, are going, is with either that or the CDs or the computers or some kind of tape recorder or something. Some guys are running around with a telephone. And you can get the whole bunch of things on a little telephone, and you do it that way. So who knows where it's going from here?
Yeah. Well, it's just several years ago I interviewed Jim Hilton, who, of course, came out with the Hilton machine, and he told me at that interview that the day will come when an amplifier will be the size of a pack of cigarettes. And, of course, that's pretty well come true now.
That's pretty well has.
Yeah. And I also should mention, actually, that, of course, there's some of us who remember way back before vinyl, everything was on shellac. And shellac records were really heavy. And there were, when vinyl came along, that saved a lot of space and weight. So
no, I believe that was before my time. I don't.
Yeah, well, but anyway, so you actually never had your own studio then, is that right?
Yes, we've had a studio in our house.
I see.
We still have. I'm using it for office space. That Stan has used in his development, but we've also rented music stores and things in Knoxville and all around, so we've moved around in different places,
yeah,
with our own studio.
Right.
And sometimes we'd go to a larger studio and, you know, and use it, but the way we got the recording, instead of having so many different players, you'd just have certain ones, and they'd come in at different times, and then you could mix the music, and so we've had like that. But yeah, we've had studios, our own studios, all over the place. Stan, now my son, he lives in Knoxville, and he has a studio in his house now, and he's still doing recordings for all kinds of people, and so.
Yeah, I see.
You don't have to have the type studios that you used to have with all the acoustic things and so on, with all this digital stuff.
Well, I remember the first recordings I made was with Folkcraft, and they were in Newark, New Jersey. Frank Galtman was the owner, and he had his studio in his dining room table.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
Elvis and a lot of his stuff, and just one comment along those lines, my son was telling me the other day, he said, of course, everything for a while was the live music sound or the naturalness of, like Elvis, when those guys performed everything, there were certain mistakes and things, but it was real. Now everything is so perfect. It's really taken something away from the sound, so I think that's what some of the purists are liking. They like to hear some of those the early sounds like that.
Yes.
Some of Elvis's stuff was actually bad, but it was hit. People enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, you certainly got a great point there. And how many recordings did you finally wind up with? Do you remember?
Well, I don't think I can count them. I know it's well over 1,000 because of our number system. But we had two or three different labels, and then I did some stuff for, like, Cal Golden's label that I had, and Gold Star, along with Red Boot Star. Reason we started Red Boot Star was for Elmer. He was a star, you know, and we just started just for him. I started to mention that at Colored Up and never thought of it. But that's...
What other labels were there?
We had Red Boot Star. I had a few I released on Flutter Wheel label I started, and then
had
two or three pretty good records, and now I don't even have any of them. I don't know what's happened to them, but we did some. And then I also... Ken Anderson had a label, J Bar K, John Hendren, and he started, and I bought that label from Ken.
Oh yes.
So I had quite a few on the J Bar K label, and had some that he had recorded, and then we did a lot of others. So that was part of our wardrobe.
So when was it you started with Elmer Sheffield?
The first one, I don't remember the exact first one. I remember the first five that he did that Bob Osgood, that little thing he had going, sets an order, he picked the number one. He got the number one five times in a row there.
Oh, yeah.
It was Good Morning Country Rain was his big one, and then he had Monday Morning Secretary, and
he was your superstar anyway.
He was for a while, and then right at the time he was interested in getting into recording, and he brought his band up with Stan with our studio, and that's where we recorded Elvira.
Oh, yes.
And that one really boomed. Stan engineered it, and his band played it, and we did that. And after that, then Elmer started his label and ESP. And
you two have been friends for a long time.
Yes, certainly have. Because he lives in Tallahassee, and it's a long way off, but I've been down there a time or two and worked with him. But in recent years, he's been doing more recording than I have, really. And of course, right now, none of us can do much because you lose a bunch of money anytime you do it.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
It just don't pay out. So, but we do a little bit now, just for because we like it. And,
So it's kind of too bad that the way somebody buys a recording and then they pass it around to their friends, and because it's so easy to do.
Everybody does it.
Yeah, and so I hope it's not the end of the recording business somehow.
I don't know where it's going to take, but that's certainly what's going on. It's kind of hard on the professional musicians, I guess.
Yeah. Well, did you always use the same band?
No, I used there for a 10-year period, I had about the same group. And then other than Stan, I've used different ones. The last, 20 years, Stan did most of it himself. And then if we wanted to do something bluegrassy, we would hire some professional with those kind of players, fiddle players and banjos and so on. And then we'd hire, you always had a guitar, but sometimes a different people, so he used different ones, and then we'd get the recording that I wanted, and then he'd mix it down, and we'd go from there. So as far as just having one band come in and play everything, that didn't last long in the early years. Some musician was always out of socket, you know. You'd have to replace him with somebody.
You're not doing much calling these days, or are you?
Yes, I'm busy all the time. I don't travel like I did. I've got from up in the East Tennessee area here. I called over in Asheville. I had a club for 44 years. It was a great club, and many times I've been over the mountain, but I still call for a club here in Johnson City, up in the Tri-Cities in Tennessee here, and then I call occasionally for, we don't have very many clubs anymore, for the Tennessee Eastman, and I go to, I'm on staff down at Knoxville, so I guess I call for about three clubs, and then I have a little group, I have an advanced group and a C1 group, and just a small group that we call for them once a week. And then since that's not enough, I do line dancing. I got into that about 20 years ago, and it's just been successful, so I do quite a bit of the line dance teaching these in the senior centers and stuff like that.
I see, yeah. Well,
so it keeps me going pretty much. I'm 81 now. I'm going to try to keep going as long as I can.
Well, that's great. So is your voice problem going to be more of a problem?
I think I have it manageable. What it is, it's voice tremor, and they diagnosed it at Vanderbilt, and it's a uncontrollable vibration of the vocal cords.
I see.
And it's an inherited thing with certain people. It's in our family. My son has it. My mother had it. I have a cousin that had it, and it kind of, as you get a little older, it kind of gets worse and hard for you to sustain a note and, you know, sing like you'd like to. But this Botox thing, and now at Vanderbilt, they, you know, like the women have a Botox shot and make them pretty.
Yeah.
That's what they use, and they put in their vocal cord a Botox shot. So I go down there about three times a year now.
Uh-huh.
I'll go back in September, and I'm just do it one side at a time, because if you do both sides, it puts you out of business for about two or three weeks until you can get back to talking, and I can't afford that, so
sure.
I just do one at a time. And a lot of musicians and teachers and singers and people down there, so they're very professional at Vanderbilt, and then this keeps me, it's not great, but it's, as you can tell, you can understand me, and I can sing and still do my thing, so I think it will enable me to keep going for a while.
Well, that's great. So, well, speaking of calling, I know you said you're calling advanced and a little bit of C1. Do you do any contras?
Yes, I do a little bit of everything, I guess. I don't do a lot, but I do some, like the Virginia Reel and the Manning's Mixer and things like that. I have very successfully, for the last, I guess, 15 years, I have some college groups of young people, and I'll get, they book me every year for their specials. And some of the groups are church-affiliated and so on. But we'll have as many as 100 to 150 kids at one time.
Yeah.
And the contra, especially the Virginia Reel, I use the Dickens out of that.
Yeah.
And
how about round dances?
Well, Mildred and I used to do a little of that, and it looks like I'm going to have to come up with something. We're just about out of cures up here in Upper East. The only one we've got left has a cancer problem, and we don't know if she's going to make it. So I've been playing tapes, or CDs rather. I have it on my computer and doing it that way.
Yeah.
And I have done a little of it, and I do round dance, but I don't think with my voice I want to try it myself. If I could start over, I might do that.
There you go.
But that's cueing, and the way it goes now, to call and cue both and do a lot of it, you just about wear your voice out.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Bob Barnes down there in Florida just about did that. He'd do so many sessions and squares, he would call C1 and everything else, and then cue rounds, and his voice would wear out every winter there. I don't know how he's been doing lately.
Right. Well, Don, during your career, your long and successful career, what's the outstanding accomplishment that you're proud of?
Outstanding accomplishment? Well,
probably Red Boot.
I think probably we have a few records there that I think have been like Jacqueline's Waltz, and Round Dancing has been pretty well internationally known, and then we did some like Elmer's, some of his stuff, and two or three that I did, Pink Cadillac, and some of them it was international. But I guess as far as the Red Boot Boys would have to be the biggest accomplishment as far as making the biggest noise.
Right.
And our caller schools, I enjoyed working with the callers and helping these guys get started.
Yeah.
And some of the festivals that we did, it's hard to pick. We did a lot of seminars there with Caller Lab and stuff for a few years, music stuff. I enjoyed that, but it's hard to pick. I think if I had to pick the one thing that I remember the most would be the year that I think it was the first, I don't know if it was the first one or not, the national they had in Anaheim. The following year, they were going to have a national in Memphis, and they had gotten me to do the to call the record Night Train to Memphis. I had just recorded that for John Hendren, and I think that's the year they almost had 40,000 at the national convention out there.
Oh yes,
that was the year. And then when they had the parade of states, all the people come in there, and I know that, golly, they must have been 300 squares. I've never seen so many dancers. I was I followed Charlie Pride, did the national anthem, and I followed and did the first tip with that many dancers there, and did the Night Train to Memphis, because Memphis was, a lot of them was on the floor, and they were pushing the next year's convention, you know. And to me, that was one of the highlights that I've had in my career, getting to do the Night Train to Memphis and invite everybody to Tennessee for the next year.
Yeah. Well, after all that, do you have any regrets or anything you wish you'd done differently?
Well, regrets, I don't know. I wish I had the answer to how to recruit better and to get the necessary advertising and programming and so on. As far as my own, I've really had five or six professions, and it seems that I've ended up the main one, because this is now about the 53rd year of a square dance caller. So I guess I've enjoyed it, and hope I'll have more years to come.
Right. Well, okay, well, I think then maybe we're getting down near the end, unless you can think of anything else you'd like to mention or put on the tape.
Well, no, the only thing that I can say is just I wish I could figure out how to advertise and get more people involved, and I know we're all looking for the magic way to do that.
Right.
We've just had such a drop-off in their attendance, and it's just, it's hard to understand why. But I know in this part of the country, it's square dancing itself just doesn't have a good reputation. You mention square dancing to people, and it it just kind of turns them off. They think you're doing hee-haw clog dancing or something.
Yes.
And they don't understand the class of people involved and all of that, and we've tried over the years to overcome that, but until you get them there and introduce them to it and they see it, it's hard to reach them. But
yeah,
I guess I'm looking for some way to do that.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's what CallRav's been trying to do ever since they started. So.
That's true.
Yeah.
But I've had quite a career, and my wife and I don't know what we would have done if we weren't square dancing every night someplace.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a ride.
Yes, it has. Well, so I think then maybe we'll just call this the end of the tape. I see the tape is just about to run out anyway.
Well, Bob, I appreciate you interviewing me, and I hope to see you again sometime.
Right. Well, I want to thank you too for taking the time and exercising your voice a little more than you had to.
Oh, that's all right.
And we do have quite a collection of these tapes, and they're all available on the New England Square Dance Foundation of New England's website. And we'll be talking more about that. So let's just call this a day, and I'll talk to you again later.
Okay. Thanks, Bob, very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Don. I enjoyed it, too.
Bye.
Bye.